Geekville Radio.
Welcome once again, Geeks and Geekettes. This is Seth, a.k.a. Xandrax, the mayor of Geekville and the host of Geekville Radio, coming at you with another show here. If we sound a little different, that's because due to the conditions that we're in up here in the Geekville studios, I'm actually coming at you from the Malibu studio, the backup studio, and we're going to talk the Gina Carano controversy. We're going to talk some casting stuff with Last of Us and Buck Rogers, some fun, you might say, chuckle-worthy news about the Mortal Kombat film, and we'll wind it up with some WandaVision talk. And once again, I don't have to do it alone. Coming at you from the nice, soft, padded cell in South Kakalaki, Crazy Train Jonathan Bullock.
All aboard, ladies and gentlemen. So the Malibu Studios, is that in Tony Stark's basement?
It's an undisclosed location that may or may not involve a car.
Oh, okay. I mean, from the movies, that basement looks pretty badass. I wouldn't mind setting up shop there.
The top story first hit about a week ago, but people are still talking about it, and that is Gina Carano, of course, probably most famous for Mandalorian the last two seasons. She has been fired by Lucasfilm after a series of controversial tweets. And I'm going to get the disclaimer out of the way here. If you're looking for any sort of political rant or anything like that, we're not going to go there because we try to stay politically neutral. We're going to talk the character, basically Lucasfilm, Disney, and what could happen from there. Now, I guess the big thing that I thought of when I heard this news is, well, first off, could cooler heads prevail and maybe she could get hired back on. I don't know if that'll happen because remember, about this time a year or two ago, we were talking James Gunn, and I think it might kind of be a similar thing. Do you think so, Train?
Yeah, no. I mean, James, if I remember right, Gunn's thing was a tweet that he openly admitted was probably in bad taste, and it was from like 10 years ago.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And this is current.
Whereas, Gina has not backed off what she said. And this is a tweet that was from like literally what, 2-3 weeks ago?
So
I think there's a difference there. I also think, if to stay with the Gunn comparison, that's the only time I've ever heard anything about James Gunn. It just kind of came out of the blue. And like you said, we're going to avoid politics. So I'll avoid making the statement that, why do people go back and dig through people's stuff to find that? But I'll leave it at that. I mean, because this was that old. Whereas this is not the first time Gina has said things that publicly online that didn't sit well with certain people in control at Lucas. Now, once again, to avoid the politics as best we can, it's your opinion whether you're offended by what she tweeted this time and the time before that. But obviously, there was enough of a groundswell amongst some people who were upset and people in charge upset that it led to this. So not our decision. And whether you like it or not, it is what it is. So I do think that's the major difference too, is time lapse between when the tweets happened and the action when you're talking Gunn versus Carano. Also the fact that Gunn kind of admitted that's probably in poor taste. He tried to explain what he was trying to say in his controversial tweet. He didn't make any excuse for it. He just said, look, I think you're misinterpreting me. Gina hasn't done any of that. She has not walked back at all, which, once again, whether you agree with what she said or not, I as an individual, I respect that. I mean, if you got enough guts to say something publicly, either back it 100% or if you do feel you made a mistake, be honest, go, look, I made a mistake. Don't sit there and try to kowtow. And I don't think Gina did that, right or wrong.
I did hear that something happened a couple months ago. I think this is around November or so. Like Disney had written up this kind of, I don't want to call it corporate, but they had basically written an apology for her to post, and she didn't want to do that. She said, look, I'll apologize, but let me use my own words. Let it come from me. And there was a disagreement there. So I think that kind of seemed to be where the spark started flying.
And you've got to understand, I think that scenario you just laid out, right or wrong, that is not that uncommon in Hollywood. If a person in Hollywood that's high profile, whether it be an actor, an actress, a director, a producer, whatever, says something that might be or does something that might be seen controversial, often they're, and I don't want to use handlers, but I can't think of any other word to use, the companies they work for will often have their PR department write up some kind of written apology. And I really don't like that. I'm gonna get on a soapbox for a second, because even if it is, even if the individual who is publicly saying the apology is sincere and they really do regret saying it, I think it's, no matter how good an actor or actress they are, doesn't it always come across as contrived to you? I mean, we just made the Iron Man analogy. That's the whole ending of the first Iron Man movie, isn't it? How S.H.I.E.L.D. has come up with this story for Tony to tell the press, and you can tell Tony's heart's not in it, to the point where at the end he goes, you know what, I am Iron Man. And then all the press goes nuts. That's just me. I would rather deal with an actor, actress, a producer, a director, whatever, being a complete jerk and being honest and upfront about it, even if they do feel that way. That's just my opinion. Let them say it in their own words. Don't script them. If what got them in trouble was something that they said, either thinking out loud or from their heart, the apology or explanation needs to come from the heart, not from some PR firm. That's just my opinion. I'm sure you probably agree with me, but if you don't want to say that publicly, I understand that as well, too.
Well, it reminds me of a segment that happened probably 10 years ago, and I'll make a wrestling analogy here. I forget the exact angle, but Randy Orton had done something dastardly, and he was supposed to apologize. And you know how good Orton would do with stuff like this. So he comes out, and he's clearly reading from a card, and it's all the corporate speak and all of the and he's just like flatly telling it like with no enthusiasm whatsoever. It's like that's what those press releases kind of wind up sounding to me.
Yeah, like I said, even if the person honestly is contrite in what they've done, let them express their contriteness and their regret.
Yeah, let it come from their own words, their own mouth.
Once again, if this is true, if this is what Gina said, and that was the original thing months ago, once again, my opinion, if you got a problem, write me, not the podcast or Seth. I respect her for that. We all make mistakes. We're all adults. We've all said things or done things that we didn't realize at the time how they were going to, we didn't read the room, so to speak, right?
Thankfully, most of the times I did that were before Twitter and Facebook came along.
Right. And so sometimes it takes another person to come to you and say, hey, look, do you understand how this was perceived? A little bit keep behind the curtain, not to get too personal. I've done that for you and vice versa before, Seth, where you brought up one thing and I said, no, wait a second here, Seth. So you're saying to prove this point, you did this. And you're like, oh, I never thought of it that way. You know?
Right.
And I wasn't ragging on Seth. Seth's done it to me, too. It's not that we're ragging on each other. It's just we each have our individual point of view and perception of things. And when you say something as an individual, you may not be seeing it the way other people do. So the idea that somebody comes to somebody, a boss comes to an employee and says, hey, you said something publicly. Yeah, so? Well, have you ever thought it could have been perceived this way and this is why? And then, oh, I never thought of it that way. So that might be very sincere. Might have been one of those things where Gina said, ooh, I never thought of it that way. Let me make an apology. Oh, well, we prepared an apology for you. And that's where she put her foot down. She's like, no, right. No. I fully accept that you've pointed out to me in a way that I understand why it might have been offensive. But let me say that it was offensive and apologize for it. I'm reminded of that great line from the Buddy Holly story, Gary Busey, where he gets to the record company and they've already pressed the demo of That'll Be the Day before they've signed him, which would never happen in today's music world, but in the 1950s, good. And it's very Hollywoodized. That's not really what happened. It was similar, but not really what happened. But when he explains to the record executive, they owe him money, and he wants to go in the studio and produce his own stuff and do it his own way. I want to make my music my way. And the line he says is, look, I've been down the road where other people control me, went down that road in Nashville, and I'd rather do it my way or not do it all. If that's the case, I'd rather be shoveling you-know-what back in Texas. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that I think that's kind of the mentality that's going on here. I'd rather say it my way or just not say it at all, because if I'm not, what's the point?
If memories are all I sang, I'd rather drive a truck.
Thank you, Rick Nelson. Who, of course, changed it to Rick from Ricky, but we digress. That's for another time. Maybe we'll do a nostalgia trip on Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet at some day time, but I don't know. But anyway, I mean, it's happened. We can't deny it. Like I said, we don't, you can agree or disagree with what Gina said. You can agree or disagree with the action Lucasfilm took. It's happened. So where do we stand now, Mandalorian, because of this, in your opinion?
Well, I've heard people talk about recasting. I'm not sure that would work. I've heard about writing off the character. I don't think that even needs to be done, because at the end of Mandalorian season two, I mean, she's kind of gone off and become a marshal. I mean, well, she was a marshal going into the final episode, but I mean,
for the New Republic. Yeah.
Right. But the good guys won. The day is saved. Grogu goes off to the Jedi Temple. So do we really need to have, from just a simple storyline standpoint with the Mandalorian, do we really need the further adventures of Cara Dune? The character doesn't necessarily need to be seen again. Now, I'm sure Jon Favreau would love to have her back, because if I heard right, he created that character specifically for Gina.
Yeah, my understanding is not only did he write the character of her, he auditioned no other actress but Gina Carano for the role. And this is not something that is unheard of in Hollywood. I think I've brought up on past podcasts, I know we've talked about it off mic, in the Quentin Tarantino film Jackie Brown, which is, I think, one of Quentin's most underrated movies, for what it's worth. It's, of course, is an adaptation of a Elmore Leonard novel called Rum Punch. But the way he wrote the character of Jackie Brown and Max Cherry, who were portrayed respectively by Pam Grier and Robert Forster, God rest his soul, was done by Quentin with those two actors in mind. He did not want to cast anybody. In fact, that's how he approached Pam to even play the role of Jackie Brown. He basically went to her and said, "Hey, look, I wrote this movie for you." And Pam's like, "Oh, wow, one of the hottest young directors in Hollywood, who everything he touches is gold, has written a movie that is a starring vehicle for me. How do I say no?"
Right. You know what? I've heard Ernie Hudson say something similar, where he said, whenever I'm approached with a role where somebody comes to me and says, "Hey, we think you'd be good in this role," it's like, I'm always flattered, no matter what the role is. You know, I'm flattered that they come to me.
He made his name playing a character that was originally written for Eddie Murphy. So,
right.
he probably's like, I've been down this road before. You know, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. But I don't think that's unusual in Hollywood, is what I'm saying. So I'm like, these are all rumors. I can't verify this, but I've heard the same thing, and I get it. And I think Favreau, once again, to try to stay non-political, he's kind of the same way. He's one of the people in Hollywood. I can't think I've ever heard him publicly, through either actions or tweets or anything, say anything political one way or the other. Have you?
No, I haven't. And he seems to be the type of person, at least publicly, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything.
Yeah, that's kind of how he's always struck. And for what it's worth, I think Favreau, from my understanding, the first time Gina got a little sideways looks from the higher ups at Lucasfilm over earlier stuff, he kind of went to bat for her, and that probably explains why. I do know in the fallout to this, several of her cast members, like Carl Weathers and Pedro Pascal, have spoken in her defense and basically said, "Hey, she's a good person. She has the right to say whatever she wants, whether you agree or disagree. It's not going to affect what we do on the show." And it's always existed. It's just more prevalent now, I think, because with social media, these people now have a very public platform with which to voice their opinions. But there's always been a segment of the population that just gets outraged and gets mad about certain things. And they are not able, as a wrestler, believe me, I saw this from fan base there constantly, where they cannot separate the individual from the artist and the art that they create. There are people who are absolutely repugnant, and nobody will want to have anything to do with them in their private life, but they're incredible actors or actresses who are really good. That's kind of what acting is, isn't it? To play another person, essentially?
Yeah, you're essentially paid to lie.
Mm-hmm. And I will say this about Gina's portrayal of Cara Dune. Many people who are not MMA fans, when she first showed up on everybody's radar, of course, in Deadpool as an actress, "Well, who is this?" Well, that's Gina Carano. She's one of the first really big women. She was the big women in MMA before Ronda Rousey, is what I'll tell them, because I'm an MMA fan, so I know about her MMA career. And they're like, "Oh, okay." They have all those people that have said, "Well, yeah, I can tell, you know, she's a jock who who's now trying to get into acting. They have all made the statement to me that the leap she made in acting ability from Deadpool to Mandalorian were huge. They felt that she was good and that she had made significant strides. And going back and watching Deadpool myself again during the first season run of Mandalorian, I can't say I disagree with them. She did make a lot of improvements. I don't know if that's because she went and got some acting classes, different directors, who knows? So for what it's worth, there are those that seem to be defending. And I mean, somebody like Carl Weathers especially, this Hollywood's game he's been in for a long time. He's seen it all come and go. And so if anybody that's involved with the show, Carl Weathers would be the most, because I would dare say outside of some of the higher-ups at Lucas, he's probably been in this game longer than anybody else tied to the show. Wouldn't you agree?
I think so, yeah. And Carl Weathers, I mean, he is more than just an actor. He's a filmmaker as well. He's done directing. He directed an episode in Mandalorian.
Yeah, and producing. So he's seen it from all aspects. He's seen the game long enough to understand that just because a person acts a certain way off camera doesn't mean they can't bring the goods on camera. And I don't think you survive in Hollywood as long as Carl Weathers has if you aren't willing to work with every type of political views, personalities, whatever. So that's why I think when it comes to Carl.
Just to clarify, my understanding is Disney was the one that essentially stepped in. And
right.
So it makes me wonder if there's going to be some sort of conversation between Disney and Lucasfilm. Because now that, again, going back to James Gunn, you know, it was like Disney fired James Gunn, but Marvel wanted to keep him. And there was kind of a talks between Disney and Marvel. So I don't know. I'm not saying this would happen, but maybe it would.
But this is the world of corporate, you know, and I'm not trying to rag on Disney. I'm not. I have a lot of issues with Disney, but this isn't one of them, because every big business is guilty of this, that if somebody gets a burr under their saddle, to quote the great Colonel Sherman T. Potter from MASH, somebody gets a burr in their britches or a burr in their saddle and they're a higher up, they can make life difficult for everybody farther down the chain from them.
Right. Poop rolls downhill.
Poop rolls downhill. Exactly. And so we can talk all we want about high level people at Lucasfilm or John Favreau or Filoni, which I haven't really heard anything one way or the other about Dave Filoni and where he stands on this issue. All these other members of the cast, it does not matter if it's somebody higher than them who's made this call. There's nothing they're going to do. They can do about it. And they understood that it's the system. It is what it is. So
right.
It's like actors and actresses, directors and producers, especially when they get into this world, they realize, okay, I'm making a Star Wars show, which means I'm going to have to answer to Lucasfilms. And that also means Lucasfilms answers to Disney. They understand that coming into it. And I've heard all this speculation. Well, they're all so upset. Favreau is going to leave. Are you kidding me? The Mandalorian is one of the most successful television shows in the world. I don't care how much these people are upset about it. They knew the score coming into the game. They're going to roll with the punches and just keep going. You're not going to leave one of the top shows right now in the world because one minor cast member said something that you didn't find offensive or you don't like how they were treated over just something they said. You're not going to leave over that. That is not a hill I don't think anybody involved is going to die on. That's my opinion. What say ye?
I agree. And I mean, I don't know how much influence George Lucas himself has had over Mandalorian. I mean, there are images of him on the set, but of course, all of George's career, he was basically the most successful independent filmmaker. Everything stopped with him.
I wonder if George's involvement parallels that of John Carpenter's in the remake, the terrible, I might add, remake of The Fog 15, 20 years ago, where Carpenter said he got a producing credit, which basically meant he showed up on set two times, had a cup of coffee, shook everybody's hand, then went home and cashed a check. I don't know if that's what Lucas's involvement is. I understand, obviously, Star Wars is a much bigger franchise than The Fog ever was, but Lucas and Carpenter are from the same generation. They went to film school at Southern Cal around the same time. They're friends. They know each other. They both are very independent-minded filmmakers who, let's be honest, are both kind of pioneers in their own way. Don't you agree?
Absolutely, yeah.
And both strike me as extremely fiercely independent guys, and both are guys that kind of like to direct their own material. Well, George did write the foundation in Star Wars for what Mandalorian's based on. And John did write Fog. It was not only directed by John, but he scripted it as well. So there are similarities there in the sense that you're dealing with properties that both of them, it's their baby, it's their brainchild, and now it's in the hands of somebody else. So as a parent, I can kind of understand that trepidation and fear you have the first time you leave your kid with a babysitter. I mean, as an uncle, I'm sure you're dealing with that now. When your brother and sister-in-law ask you to watch the kids, sometimes there's that, we trust you, Seth, but.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know. George is also, once again, to make the parallels to Carl Weathers, George has been in this game long enough to realize how to be savvy. Yes, he's very independent-minded, and George does what he wants to do, but he realizes sometimes it's not a hill you want to die on, because if you do, you're going to destroy the ability to do something else down the road. It's like everything in life that we all individuals deal with. You have to decide, is this a hill I'm willing to die on? We all make those decisions every day, don't we?
I never really thought of it that way, but I think you're right.
I do it all the time. I do it all the time, especially at my job, where I'm told to do something a certain way, and I'm like, oh, God, I don't want to do it that way. That seems counterproductive, or it's going to take me twice as long. Let me do it my way. And in my job, I will admit, I have a lot of autonomy, and they give me a lot of leeway. But when my boss says, no, we want you to do it this way, I got to swallow my pride and do it and decide, okay, is this a hill I want to die on or not? Am I willing to go to bat and say, no, I know we need to do it this way because it'll be easier, and that is not the way you said. Let me explain it. Nothing against Gina Carano and nothing against the role, the character of Cara Dune. I think it goes back to what you said originally. Is really a minor character like that, is that something you're willing to die? You're going to die on? It isn't like they said, okay, we're going to do something to baby Grogu or to Mando himself. Then maybe George would get involved, right? But a minor character that's my opinion at least.
Right, right.
And I think you're right, though. I even have fans that came to me and asked me, was The Mandalorian over? And I said, what do you mean? And these were fans. I think it was partly based on the post-credit scene that set up the Book of Boba Fett, which we now know is probably going to be a separate show. It's not going to be the third season of Mandalorian. I can understand why that question was asked, because kind of the way the second season ended, the main storyline for two seasons had been Mando getting Grogu and then getting him to the Jedi. And that story arc is now completed. Grogu's gone off with Luke. So the only way I would have seen Cara Dune involved personally for how I would go, she'd be one of those characters that maybe three seasons from now, whatever the current adventures are for Mando, takes him back to that part of that star system. And he shows up and like a guest starring role for one episode. Does that make sense?
Right.
It's not the Timothy Oliphant role, but 3 years from now.
Makes sense, yeah. Because my hunch has been, this is purely my speculation, I kind of figure that she'd play a big part of that Rangers of the New Republic series. Because that seems to me like that might be kind of the Avengers thing, where it's all the Mandalorian Favreauverse, whatever you want to call it, all the characters banding together.
That was one that I did speculate, that there's a character you've introduced as a legitimate marshal, ranger, whatever you want to call them. Marshal, I think, was her official title, right?
Yeah.
So that was one that I agreed with you. I thought, well, but then again, you can quickly drop a character like that. Because, I mean, they hadn't even started filming that yet. I don't even know if they even have a spec script for that. Just a name and a synopsis, and there's where they're going to go. So I don't know. But I agree. I mean, I think a lot of people's like, oh, we're going to see more Luke now. No, we're not. Luke's gone, and baby Grogu's gone. Now, I will say this. I do feel that it was a risk by Favreau and Filoni to end the story where they essentially wrote off one of the most popular characters and one of the reasons for its success in Grogu, if they're going to go the route I'm talking about. But the show's The Mandalorian. It's not the Grogu. It's not Baby Yoda. So it's about the Mandalorian's story, not Baby Yoda's story. And so I got no issues with me personally with that story ending. Now, if they want to do another show where we see Luke training Grogu, that possibility's there. But what point is there in having the training of a young Jedi in a show that's called The Mandalorian, that's about the Mandalorians and the Bounty Hunter Guild? It kind of makes no sense, doesn't it? Since they've wrapped up this whole storyline, what say ye on that one?
I agree. I mean, if they want to have some sort of spinoff show, the Grogu show or whatever, and where it's training, then that's fine. Now, I do think we are going to see Grogu again. It might not be too. Now. Maybe they it'll be a couple years later, and maybe he's grown a little bit, and maybe he can talk or something to that effect. But yeah, I don't think we're going to see him anytime soon. It's probably going to be another year or so before we see a little Grogu again.
Well, since I've already made the MASH analogy, I'll go ahead and make our obligatory Doctor Who reference for this episode. You as a Whovian know the Doctor changes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They go different avenues and stories with each Doctor. That doesn't change the fact it's still about Doctor Who, right?
Right.
Same philosophy, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. And they all the Doctors, they come back at some point. You know, Doctor has met himself probably a dozen times by now.
And I mean, when a popular Doctor decides to leave, there's always a certain part of the fan base that's upset. I know a lot of Whovians were not happy when Tennant left, but then they gave Matt Smith a chance, and they liked Matt. So I'm sure there were Matt Smith fans that were not happy when he left, and then they were fine with Capaldi. So it happens.
Right.
It's part of doing episodic serial television. But you know, my point being, the MASH fan, that was an ensemble cast that the focus was the MASH unit in the Korean War, not the characters. Now, granted, obviously Hawkeye was the central character, right? And he remained through the whole run of the show. But how many different changes did they have in that cast over time? Several.
Right. Winchester
replacing Frank. Potter replaced Colonel Blake. Radar left, and Klinger got elevated from a bit player to, you know, a regular cast member. They increased the storylines for Father Mulcahy. At the end of the show, there were supporting characters like Sergeant Rizzo and stuff that got more. He was the motor pool sergeant, played by G.W. Bailey. Who, by the way, we need to do a nostalgia trip on the Police Academy movies, but I digress. But I mean, that's what I'm saying. Is there are ways in successful shows to do it. Change is inevitable. The good shows that have solid writing and good directing and hire good cast members keep going, even when popular characters leave and popular storylines are wrapped up. I think that's my point.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're getting at, is whether Gina comes back or not, the show is going to go on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have some more news about the Mandalorian himself, Pedro Pascal. What is that news?
Well, Pedro Pascal has been cast in the HBO adaptation of The Last of Us, which is a video game adaptation, right?
Yes. One of probably the most successful video games in the last 10 years. And for those that haven't heard of it, aren't video gamers, it is on the levels of Red Dead Redemption, Grand Theft Auto, Call of Duty, that level of, you know, Assassin's Creed.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting an HBO adaptation. Assassin's Creed got its own movie that bombed, but still cast Michael Fassbender. So it's on that level. You follow what I'm saying?
Right. But this has caused fans to speculate, oh, what does this mean for The Mandalorian? And I think Pedro, I mean, he knows what his schedule is likely going to be for The Mandalorian as far as where he has to be. Because remember, the majority of his work in Mandalorian has been voice work. So I think it's very feasible that they can work around his Mandalorian schedule or vice versa. And I just kind of compare it to make an 80s analogy. I compare it to William Daniels. I mean, he was in two shows concurrently. He was acting in front of the camera in St. Elsewhere. And
while he was the voice of Kit.
And he was the voice of Kit. And those shows were on at the same time. So that's why I think that was why he was never credited as Kit.
Yeah, I go back to what I said earlier about Favreau and everybody else involved. Are you really going to quit one of the number one shows in the world right now? No.
Right.
That'd be stupid. And do you think that Warner Brothers didn't realize when they were talked to pass Pedro that he was tied into this top show? And you don't think the people at Disney and Lucasfilm, he didn't come to them and say, hey, look, I mean, just to stay within the MCU itself. How many times, I mean, Nick Fury, Samuel L. Jackson's portrayal of Nick Fury has crossed over into more of aspects of the MCU than any other character. Him and Coulson are the glue that kind of held it all together for the first three phases. And obviously his role was more pronounced in certain films or certain TV shows than they were in others. But even he made a walk-on appearance on the first or second episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yeah, I think he was in the first one, and I think he was in the finale as well.
I think it was season three, was the payoff was the end of Age of Ultron, where they were working the whole season, for the whole first half of the season to get that old helicarrier out of dry dock. and get it running again, which, of course, then Nick shows up with Maria and uses to save the people of Sokovia. Samuel Jackson's the hardest working man in Hollywood. You don't think Disney didn't realize when they hired him to such an important role that was going to be involved in so many properties? They realize, you know, Sam's like, now you do realize I do other movies. And Sam has done other movies during this run. He hasn't had the high profile roles like Jules from Pulp Fiction or whatever, but he still has done other work all during this last 10 years of, or 11 years now, I guess it is, or 12, whatever it is, of the MCU. So this is not new to Hollywood, especially since the old contract player system died in the 60s and 70s. Especially if you cast in a television show a movie actor. And I've always felt that though Pedro made his name in Game of Thrones, I think he's more known as a movie guy than he is a TV guy. Would you agree with that summation?
I'm trying to think of other movies he did, and I know he's in Wonder Woman 84.
Yeah. Well, he's Chilean. I think he actually was in foreign films before he was in American films. So, but my point is, that's something you know when you cast actors often, that if they're in demand, you might have to work around schedules. I think to stay in the geek world, Stephen Amell, when he had that match for the WWE, you don't think the people at the WWE and the people, you know, Berlanti and those guys and CW, this was all worked out amongst them so it didn't affect the filming schedule of Arrow?
Exactly.
I mean, it's how many actors can you think of that also have bands that are musicians? Gwyneth Paltrow, Gary Sinise, Keanu Reeves, Kevin Bacon. I could keep going. All of them are doing pretty good and still doing TV shows and movies, yet they're still putting out albums and touring some of their music, aren't they?
Yep.
It can be worked out, is what I guess my point.
And with Mandalorian, I mean, we know now that each season is usually 8 episodes. So we don't know how many episodes Last of Us is going to be, but a lot of these specialty shows like Mandalorian, they don't tend to run 20-episode seasons. They tend to run 8, 10, 12-episode seasons.
Right, right. And so we don't, and with a heavy special effects show like Mandalorian, how much of that is actually post editing and special effects?
A lot of it's in the volume, so it's a lot of it's just digital backgrounds anyway.
Right. A lot of it's probably second unit stuff, establishing shots, things like that. And to drive this home one more time, this is not unusual for even Lucasfilm before the Disney buyout. Pretty sure James Earl Jones was acting in other roles while he was doing Darth Vader during the run of the original trilogy, wasn't he?
Exactly, yeah.
And we know without a doubt, this is not like Mandalorian where sometimes Pedro's in the outfit and sometimes it's his stunt double, but he's always doing all the voice work. This was a different actor inside the Darth Vader costume. This was David Prowse.
Dave Prowse, you know, yeah.
Who just passed away. God rest his soul. You know, this is David Prowse in the suit. All the voice work is done by James Earl Jones in post. Yet James Earl Jones was still acting. He was still a well-respected actor during that whole run in the late 70s, early 80s, doing other movies. So it didn't affect him. And I would say, once again, to stay in Star Wars, to drive this voice work versus live acting, other things, Mark Hamill has said, and James Earl Jones has too, for that matter, they love doing voice work. It's a big paycheck for not a lot of work. And in today's day and age with the technology we have, I would bet they don't, especially during the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, they probably don't even have to go in the studio to do some of this, do they?
I've heard that a lot of voice actors, that's what they did. They got their home studio and then they can just send what's needed via email.
Yeah. I mean, and this has been around for a while. I mean, and music was probably the first to do that. Yeah. I mean, for not to get off topic to another topic, but you're a music guy too. I'm sure you're well aware of the fact is, I mean, it's even in the liner notes, the last album that the Eagles did before they got back together, which was Long Run in 79. They had gotten so bitter between all the members of the band. Each one of them was recording their own part in their own home studio, sending the tapes in, and then it was all put together in post, which when you understand the vocal harmonies that the Eagles do is pretty amazing. It can be done, I think, is our point, that we've beaten that to death. But it's I don't see Pedro leaving because that just would be stupid on his part. And I think Disney realizes that he is a fan favorite. It would be dumb to get rid of him. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk Buck Rogers and we'll talk some Mortal Kombat, shall we say, silliness. This is Geekville Radio, and we will be right back.
Are you looking for a gaming-themed podcast? check out You Just Got Fragged. Join host Jared Aubrey and his panel of gaming enthusiasts as they discuss news and accomplishments in the gaming world, and of course, the gripe of the week. That's all at YouJustGotFragged.com, part of the Wrestling Brethren podcast family.
All right, we are back, and an interesting news bit hit last week or so, and this kind of falls into the, okay, another reboot or another remake, and that is Buck Rogers. But the interesting thing here is George Clooney is reportedly working on it. He's going to produce it. There's a rumor that he's going to star in it. I'm not sure how that would work out. There's also supposedly a Buck Rogers movie that they're just trying to get off the ground by a competing company. So there might be some legal battles for rights over that. But I'm not sure about George Clooney as Buck Rogers acting, and maybe he'll play another role. I suppose he could try. He could do action. But I mean, the guy is what, pushing 60 now.
Yeah, but I mean, Ocean's 11 had action in it, and what was that? Three Kings, the one with him and Wahlberg and Ice Cube, where they played the soldiers in Iraq. That obviously was a war movie. And there's action elements in what was that Coen Brothers movie he just did. But I mean, realistically, Channing Tatum winds up being the guy that does most of the action in that. But I digress. Hail Caesar, whatever that movie was a few years ago.
But I will say, if it's done well, I could go for a Buck Rogers revival. I mean, I grew up, of course, most of my familiarity is the Gil Gerard TV show, but I knew it was a comic strip. And because Buck's one of those characters we could do a nostalgia trip or even a Lesser Known Geek Hall of Fame on.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we've discussed both, that maybe Buck Rogers is worthy of an induction in the Lesser Known Geek Hall of Fame. I think we had that discussion right after we did the Flash Gordon one.
Right.
And we've definitely discussed doing a nostalgia trip on the TV, the Gil Gerard TV show, mostly because, well, for me, Erin Gray, but she looked quite fetching in those tight little outfits they had her in that show. But I agree with you. I don't see Clooney as Buck Rogers necessarily, but I mean, if he is a producer, he's produced some good stuff. I mean, he's a good producer.
Yeah, I think he's behind those Ocean's movies, right?
I believe so. And George is one of those guys. Obviously, he has the heritage with his with Rosemary being his aunt and everything, to go back to that era of Hollywood. I felt, as much as I hate remakes, and if you know anything about me, yes, I'm a big headbanger. Yes, I make all the country music posts. I'm a big fan of like that old crooner style of singing. I mean, I love Dean Martin. I love Sinatra and Nat King Cole and those guys. And I was like, oh man, they're gonna remake the quintessential Rat Pack movie is Ocean's 11, the original. But then when they found out Clooney was involved, I was like, you know, he's one of the few guys in Hollywood that kind of has that old Rat Pack vibe to him, that kind of like cool. So I thought for what they were, I didn't think they were bad. Did you?
No, I quite liked them.
You're never going to be cooler than Sammy Davis Jr., though Don Cheadle tried. You're never going to be cooler than Sinatra, but Clooney tried. You're never going to be cooler than Dean Martin, but Brad Pitt tried. And they did pretty good. I mean, it was what it was.
Right.
I do think Clooney, as a producer, is a good thing. I think he understands that era of Hollywood, like I said, because of his family and just kind of an old-school cool factor I think Clooney has. As you like to say, Clooney is one of those guys that makes walking into a room interesting. He just has that kind of natural charisma about him. I'm sure you agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Another actor I can think of that's a little older than him I would put in that category it'd be Richard Gere. They're both extremely good looking men. That probably helps too, you know. But so we'll see where it goes. I'm with you though. I'm down with the Buck Rogers revival. I don't have the disdain for remakes of television shows as much as I do movies. I don't know if you have an opinion on that. Do you?
I think for me, it's remakes in general, because some of these remakes are where it's like, okay, Hollywood has no ideas left because they're going to remake this classic that nobody wants to see. But
as I always say, the dearth of creativity in Hollywood.
Right. But there's been some Flash Gordon revivals over the years. But I don't recall there being a Buck Rogers one since the Gil Gerard TV show. So it's been 40 some years.
Right.
I'm willing to give it a shot.
I've had to think about this about myself ever since you gave me this news. why is it, I asked myself, Crazy Train, why do you hate remakes so much? And I began to realize the first time I think I ever saw a remake where I explicitly went into it knowing it was a remake and being a fan of the original was the Gus Van Sant remake of Psycho in the 90s.
I'd heard people that enjoyed it.
Yes, and nothing against Vince Vaughn. I think he's a great actor, especially comedic. Nothing against Anne Heche. I think she's a fine actress. It's just watching that movie and Vince Vaughn trying to be Tony Perkins, who was one of the greatest villains of all time in Norman Bates. Let's be honest. He just was. And being such a fan of a movie that is considered a classic, Alfred Hitchcock is considered one of the greatest directors Hollywood's ever known. As a horror guy, Psycho was one of the most groundbreaking horror movies ever made. I went in with a chip on my shoulder. And then the fact that Gus Van Sant, and this was his choice as a director, chose to remake that movie essentially as a shot-for-shot remake with adding nothing or bringing nothing to it. I was like, why? What was the point if you were just going to remake Hitchcock's classic? You're not adding or taking anything away. And then I found out, being a child of the 80s, I was a fan of Scarface, the Al Pacino 80s movie. I think it's probably the first time we all saw Michelle Pfeiffer, too, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. And I think that's what put De Palma on the map as well.
Just to Kill was before that.
Okay.
That was a big movie. With Michael Caine for himself. But I digress. But so it's one of those things where I didn't realize until after the remake of Psycho came out, oh, Scarface was a remake. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so I realized, and subsequently have gone back and watched the original black and white Scarface from the 30s. And I thought it was just as good as the 80s color. And that was an example of where the filmmaker took it, completely changed it. Instead of it being about Prohibition era bootleggers, Italian mob in Chicago, it was a Cuban American drug lord in the 80s. The story was the same, but how it was presented was different. And I realized, take that and the fact that I went into Psycho remake knowing it was a remake, but went into Scarface not knowing, probably skewed my opinions a little bit. I do think with Buck Rogers, because it is sci-fi and the character has such a long, rich history, there is probably more opportunity to bring something new to the table than something like Psycho. What say ye?
And with Buck Rogers, there's more freedom there.
Right.
I mean, I suppose you could go to the comic strips and the TV show for inspiration.
Ideas.
Yeah, but as long as the whole idea is you got this astronaut that's frozen in space for 500 years, then that's really all you need.
Yeah, and a Psycho by itself was very much, like I said, there was no room for it. When Hitchcock did it, he based it on the Robert Bloch novel. So he was very set. It was a novel. It was very set on this is the characters, this is the setting, this is the story. And he wasn't going to deviate, and Hitchcock didn't. And then Gus Van Sant chose not to as well.
And regarding Scarface, I mean, it's kind of hard to do, unless you do a period piece, it's kind of hard to do a movie about Prohibition in 1983.
Right. But the difference there is Scarface wasn't based on a novel like Psycho. It was based on a true life person. I mean, because the original was a very fictionalized representation of Al Capone, whereas Tony Montana is a completely different character than Al Capone. So, yeah, I think, like I said, with Buck Rogers, though, being sci-fi, not being tied down to any one thing and having already been presented in multiple different types of media, there's probably a lot more room for interpretation in a revival and a reboot, remake, whatever you want to call it.
Agreed. Yeah. All right, and we'll move on to, I kind of find this a little more lighthearted than I think other geeks will, and we're moving to the world of movie adaptions of video games. Everybody's seen by now probably the Mortal Kombat trailer that hit, I think it was last week.
It was Tuesday, wasn't it?
I think it was, yeah, as of this recording, I think about a week ago.
Yep.
And there was a piece that was written by a website, Jezebel.com, and I'll link the write-up in the show notes at geekvilleradio.com/274. And really, it's kind of all in the headline, who forgot to invite Chun-Li to the Mortal Kombat? And of course, anybody who has any familiarity with fighting games knows that Chun-Li is from Street Fighter, and
not in Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. So when I first saw this, I thought it was a joke. And I thought I was kind of laughing with it. But it turns out, I guess, this was somebody who genuinely didn't know that these were two different franchises.
Oh, yeah. She literally had to walk it back, I think, about an hour after that story dropped on Jezebel's website, going, oh, under further investigation, I discovered that Chun-Li is it Street Fighter, not Mortal Kombat. My bad.
Yeah. But I will at least give them credit that they at least left it up. I mean, it's one of those things like, okay, I messed up. You can laugh at me.
Right. I think for me personally, the message from this is, and this is once again Crazy Train getting on his soapbox more than it is anything else. We often, when I say we, I include myself in that. We as individuals often, I think, sometimes give more credence or trust to, and I use air quotes, journalists, when we read websites, when we read articles, and they're only as good as their research is. And we're trusting that they have done their research, and this was obviously from the jump a person that didn't do their research. I'm not one of those hardcore geeks, and I think Seth would agree with this. I'm much more into video gaming world than he is.
Right.
I am not one of those hardcore geeks who just wants to bury this woman and bury Jezebel. How dare you hire a person to write a story about a video game that's never even played the video game? I'm not that. I mean, how many baseball writers and football writers never played baseball or football?
Right.
I'm not one of those. Come on, guys. I agree with you that she probably, not probably, should have done more research, and she screwed the pooch, but she owed up to it. She owed up to it. She said, oops, I made a mistake. I'm not going to get into what her motivations were for why she wrote the article to begin with, but we all make mistakes, and I want to express to our listeners, that includes us.
Whenever we do these shows, I mean, we try to make it clear, if we're wrong on something, correct us, we'll own up to it.
An example where we can be wrong. About a year ago, if you remember, the country music great Charlie Daniels passed away, and we did a little segment on that as in our fandom of his. During that, I actually misattributed a song that he did not record, but that he referenced in one of his hits, and Devil Went Down to Georgia, as being written by his bass player. It was actually written by George McCorkle, who was the rhythm guitarist of Marshall Tucker Band. And I can't remember if I attribute it to Charlie's bass player or to Jerry Eubanks, the flute player but regardless, I misquoted who it was written by and mistold the story and realized it a few days later and told Seth, oh man, I screwed up, Seth. Remind me next time we record so I can correct that.
And guess who forgot to remind you?
Yeah. So here we are a year later, and I'm now correcting a mistake I made over a year ago. But my point is, we make mistakes. And this is Charlie Daniels and Marshall Tucker Band, two of my favorite acts of all time. And I have a degree in music history. If anybody should not make a mistake on something like that, it should be me. And yet I did. So it happens. I think people get very upset about that nowadays. And they need to understand in this day and age of just information coming so fast and the need for content to come so fast and the need to get stuff up. Sometimes things fall through the crack like that, and we're guilty of ourselves. Obviously, either no one cared or no one knew that I was wrong, because I didn't get anything about me messing that up. Did you, Seth? About
no.
Charlie Daniels and Marshall Tucker. Okay. So either it wasn't important enough or nobody knew. But if I had not corrected it now, like I am now, George McCorkle, God rest his soul, the rhythm guitarist for Marshall, wrote that song, offered it to Charlie Daniels. Charlie said no. Y'all record it, but I'll play fiddle on it. I'm now correcting that.
For the record, just for our listeners may not know, that's the song Fire in the Mountain.
Yes. Cheap plug, if you're following me on Facebook, you know that I'm posting a different country music video every day. That was my post last week, Monday the 15th. Go back and check it out. It's the most country-sounding song that Marshall Tucker probably did, attributed to, I would say, the pedal steel that Toy Caldwell plays on it. But I digress. If you're not familiar with the song and you want to check it out. But that's an example of, this is something that I should know better. I literally am, you know, a minor expert on music history, and I messed up. And that was in a rush for us to get information out there. And that's just going to happen in today's day and age. So quit being so hard on people. I thought it was funny that she misquoted this, that she thought Chun-Li was in this world, and she obviously had never played Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat or seen either one of the movies. I will openly admit, that's kind of a bad move because these are, I mean, those are two of the biggest franchises in all of video games. And so much so they both spawned movies. It was not hard to find the information, and she didn't. But to her credit, she came back, you know, an hour or so later and said, oops, I messed up. She's doing better than me. It took me a whole year to correct my mistake. Right. So, I mean, can you think of any time that you've made a mistake and forgot to correct it? You want to come clean now?
Probably too numerous to name.
None that are coming to mind right now. You're willing to.
Well, putting me on the spot, but
you know. Well, yeah, but my point is, we people that do podcasts, people that write for these websites, I'm not defending the mistake. I'm just explaining they do happen. And reminding all our listeners, including myself and Seth, you have access to libraries and the internet. Yes, you might want to use articles and podcasts and what have you as a jumping off point, but please do your own research too, especially if it interests you. And also don't get your butt on your shoulders if you find out down the road that article you believed was gospel truth was wrong because the writer made an honest mistake.
Agreed.
You agree with that? Okay. Oh, I wasn't sure. And I think it's a great time to remind our listeners, if we make some mistake you know about, we are not experts. We're just fans talking about things that we like and what we like about what we dislike. If we're wrong, please let us know. We want to correct that. I don't know about Seth, but me personally, I don't want to say something on one of these podcasts that is extremely wrong. And then 2 years down the road, some guy or some gal who's listened to it and took what we said as gospel truth got in some kind of terrible argument because they're misquoting the truth because they're quoting us. I don't think it's going to happen over geek stuff, but you never know.
Right, right.
There have been fights for less things. Let's put it that way.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to wind up the talk here. We're going to talk WandaVision episodes 6 and 7. This is Geekville Radio, and we'll be right back.
Attention all Time Lords and ladies, Geekville Radio presents Examining the Doctor, a weekly look at everybody's favorite Time Lord, the Doctor. Join Mark and Seth as they bring their signature blend of knowledge and humor to favorite and not-so-favorite episodes of Doctor Who. From Hartnell to Capaldi, Examining the Doctor provides episode commentaries for classic and current Doctor Who fans alike. Examining the Doctor, available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at geekvilleradio.com.
All right, we're back, folks. Last segment of the show. And naturally, since we're going to talk WandaVision, and I'm going to wave the spoiler tag.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler hull has been breached. Spoiler hull has been breached.
Just like the last time we talked WandaVision, when two episodes had gone by. So we're going to talk episodes 6 and 7 here. And the way I look at where they're at now, I think Episode 6 was really where they were kind of entering the third act of the story, because Vision really finds out what's going on. And this one was done up like the 2000s sitcoms, you know, like Malcolm in the Middle and such. So there was no laugh track and there was a lot of breaking of the fourth wall.
Oh, yeah. And the opening credits were a total homage to the opening credits of Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was also Pietro Heavy. This was the one where they were all dressed up in Halloween costumes that had their classic looks to it. So Wanda had the big headdress, and Vision looked like he did in the 80s.
And Pietro had like the crazy hair with the lightning bolt, light blue shirt. And once again, to toot our own horn, it looked like to us from the trailers that we had seen that look, but it looked like Halloween costumes. We were right. It was the quote unquote special Halloween episode.
Right, which always seems to come across for a lot of the sitcoms.
It's part of the formula. They don't stray from it, do they?
Right. The main takeaway that I had from this episode was the kind of acknowledging that Pietro and Wanda, these are from different universes, because they're like, why do you look different? I don't know. Why do you look different?
Right. I mean, we last time we talked, because it was the surprise ending of episode 5, where the Evan Peters version of Quicksilver shows up, and Darcy even makes the point, wait, would they recast Pietro? We speculated even back then on our last episode that maybe this is another Quicksilver. This really is Pietro. This isn't one that was created by Wanda's imagination. It really is just from another multiverse. And if that's the case, we don't know. that's going to be admission by the Disney people that the Fox stuff was its own separate universe, correct?
Right. That's what it seems to be for me. I mean, we know that the Doctor Strange sequel is going to be called Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. So that might be a way to kind of link all this together.
Right. I was able to watch since we last recorded. I don't know how I missed this. It would come out. It dropped 4 or 5 months ago. It was put out by Marvel Studios. It is their video about where Phase 4 is heading. And it was hosted by Kevin Feige. And he showed trailers for all of the television shows that are going to be on Disney Plus, WandaVision, Falcon and Winter Soldier. And he also briefly talked about all the movies that are on slate for that. And he openly mentioned Kevin Feige, that is, when he talked about Doctor Strange and the multiverse of madness, that it would directly tie into WandaVision. He openly said that. So, you know, that's verified. I will say, back on an interesting, and I haven't heard your speculation on this even off mic, so I've been waiting to ask you on mic. It was obvious that this Pietro, the Evan Peters Pietro, is either created whole cloth by Wanda or he's from another multiverse. Yet he, like Monica did, he knew what really was going on because of things that he said to Wanda. In fact, he made Wanda so mad one time when he said, "What, you think your dead husband can die again?" She blasts him with one of her hex blasts. What's up with that, dude? How is he able to know things that nobody else is? Is it because he's a mother multiverse or because he's from her? He's like her conscience. What is it? What say ye?
Well, if you look closely at the end of episode 7, because episode 7 revealed that Agnes is actually Agatha Harkness, and she's actually the villain behind this. She's the one that's been controlling things more than Wanda does, because the seventh episode, Wanda's realizing, hey, wait a minute, this stuff's changing and I can't control it. But during the musical number at the end, which looked like Munster's Addams Family tribute, it's worth mentioning that that actress, was it Catherine Hahn, I think?
Catherine Hahn.
She actually did her own singing in that, for what it's worth.
I'm sure.
But if you look closely, you'll see that when Pietro showed up and they were doing the hug thing, she's actually standing in the foreground there, kind of chuckling. And also, it was implying that Agnes/Agatha was the one that actually pulled Pietro in, whether he truly is from another multiverse or whether he was created on the spot by her. Either way, she's actually was controlling him. So I hope that answers it. So I think Pietro is being controlled or maybe was manifested by Wanda.
So then that leads me to my next question. Is this how they rebirth Pietro? When this show ends, and I don't think we're giving anything away here. Obviously, the hex is going to end somehow. That's going to be the resolution. It has to. It can't last forever. And this is just setting the table for other things to happen in the MCU. Out of this, do we get another Pietro? Is this how they bring Quicksilver back into the MCU, resurrect him, so to speak?
I'd be happy either way, whether it's the Evan Peters or whether they get the actor from the
Aaron Taylor Thomas.
Although the fan reaction seems to be that Evan Peters seemed to be the more favorable of the two. And maybe that's just because he had several movies and the MCU really only had him in one.
I also think, and I'm not a big fan of the Fox X-Men. I think I said this last time. Yeah. I think there is some truth that I just think Evan Peters, at least the way that he portrayed him, was more enjoyable.
Right.
And we forgot to mention, though, we've already moved on to episode 7. Episode 7 had a real Parks and Rec, Community, Modern Family, 2000s vibe to it, where, you know, the kind of the thing now with sitcoms is where they'll have the regular action, they'll do a cut where one of the characters is now breaking the fourth wall, sitting down with the crew and doing an interview about what you just saw. So they kind of went that route with episodes. I personally think, I mean, I don't dislike that style of, it is very popular in comedies right now. I think personally, that was something that the sitcom writers adapted from Survivor, the reality show. How they would have, when they would have the votes at the end of those shows, they would have the individual contestants be in the booth by themselves and talk about what they were going to vote for and why. Do you see why I kind of feel that way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I always kind of figured that kind of reality show touch, because it kind of humanizes the characters when they do stuff like that.
And it is just an outright breaking of the fourth wall. It isn't like you said, Malcolm in the Middle, where Malcolm would just stop and look at the camera and talk. I think that actually predates Conk in the Middle to the 80s in that Fox sitcom, Parker Lewis Can't Lose, because Parker Lewis used to do that. But this is what they do now, where they did in episode 7, where they have them just literally sitting on a couch being interviewed by the film crew is, there's no bones. They're completely breaking the fourth wall at that point.
And the way they would do it in Malcolm in the Middle and stuff, you can go all the way back to Ferris Bueller.
Well, I mean, Parker Lewis Can't Lose was essentially a ripoff of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I think that Malcolm in the Middle was kind of a ripoff of both of them. It was just a younger kid as opposed to two high schoolers.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't we get that earlier in the 80s? I would love to have seen Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High break the fourth wall. Dude, this is totally awesome. Sorry, anyways.
Now, one other thing about episode 6, because that ended with Wanda kind of expanding the size of the Hex, and that gobbled up Darcy, and of course, it turned the sword bunker, you might say, into the circus.
Which was hilarious in and of itself.
Yeah, because Darcy, they change her to one of the SUVs, and then all of a sudden she's wrapped up in chains in the circus. But it makes me wonder if Wanda actually did that herself, or did kind of Agatha tell her to do it, or maybe it was a joint effort. That's one of those things I think they'll explain to an extent. And, of course, probably the biggest thing to come out of these episodes, and I think it stems from Darcy telling Monica that her DNA's been recorded, and if she goes through again, her cells could be rewritten at a molecular level. And I think that's how they're explaining how Monica has powers now.
They didn't go deep into it. They just showed her eyes glowing blue, and she did do the superhero landing at that one point. But back to that YouTube posting, I missed it from Marvel that I was talking about earlier, where Kevin Feige verified that this WandaVision will tie into Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. Kevin Feige also verified in this same video I watched that Tiana Parks? What's the actress's name? I'm forgetting her last name.
That plays Monica, you mean?
Yes. Tiana Parks, I believe, right?
Something like,
Yeah, but he verified she will be in Captain Marvel 2 as a grown-up Monica Rambeau, and even made the comment that you will meet her in WandaVision, because remember, these were all before all the shows. So, I mean, now we've got verification that this is going to tie into two MCO movies, and it's coming straight from the mouth of Kevin Feige, which, as far as I'm concerned, that makes it gospel truth, right?
Right. I mean, because as most MCU fans know, that's kind of where the buck stops, is with Kevin Feige.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't understand. How did Wu and Monica escape when Darcy didn't originally?
Well, I think they were driving, because Darcy was chained. They chained her to one of the vehicles.
That's right. They put her in cuffs or shackles or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And they kind of hinted that she dropped an F-bomb, but she got swept up before she completed it.
Kind of similar to Nick Fury's getting dusted, right? He's getting ready to drop the F-bomb at the end of Infinity War, right?
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know that much about the Agatha Harkness character. Once again, I'm not the Marvel guy. I'm the DC guy. That would be you. You're the Marvel guy. And I'm definitely not a Fantastic Four guy. That would definitely be you, Seth. My memories of Agatha Harkness were she was a bit cruel and mean, but she was still a hero. And my memories of her is she was like much older. And though she did work some of the Scarlet Witch, my memories of her were being the governess or nanny or whatever you want to call it for Franklin Richards, Reed and Sue's kid. Do you remember that much about her in the Kirk comic book run?
No, I don't think I've read anything proper with her in it. I think maybe in passing, but yeah, you're right. She's depicted as being much older, like grandmother.
Now, I also think, and some of this is vaguely remembered, some of it's from research, she's the mother of Lord Scratch, who is a supervillain. I know this is crazy because I'm always the guy talking about I like the mystical, magic, supernatural side, and I do not know about this character. It would seem that I would know more than you would, but I really don't, you know?
Yeah, and as far as the extent of her powers, I'm not even sure that as well. And obviously in the show, she's clearly Wanda's equal, if not her superior.
Once again, I could be pulling this out of my butt because I'm not the Marvel guy. I remember somewhere in that storyline, it was revealed that she actually was one of the Salem witches that survived the Salem witch trials. So that would make her at least 300 years old, 400 years old.
Yeah, that would put it about right.
Well, if you're that magical, you can be young. I'm sure, don't you think?
But she definitely comes across as, at least in the comics, I mean, in the comics, she'd be one of those, you'd probably call her a secondary character at best, more like a tertiary character.
But, well, we've seen that in the TV shows. I mean, I love Deathlok, but he is definitely a secondary character, yet he was very important to the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, I don't know. And I wouldn't call Quake a big A-lister either, would you? And yet, Daisy Quake is like one of the main characters in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've talked about it before. That is a bonus that you get to do when you expand your universe into the television world, episodic stuff. You can touch on some of these lesser known characters because both Marvel and DC have a vast array of characters that they can tap into if they choose to.
And I think the other thing about Agatha, this might be why I'm not too familiar with her. She looks like she came along before I got into comics. I did a quick check here, and it looks like her first appearance was in 1970.
Real quick up there, am I right about her being like a Salem, one of the Salem witches?
Well, you're definitely right about her being the mother of Scratch and, yeah, protecting Franklin Richards as his nanny.
And the only reason I never remember that is, once again, Lord Scratch being a mythical-based villain, he's had run-ins in the past with Ghost Rider and Doctor Strange, two of my favorite Marvel characters. So, but let's be honest, just about every mystical-based character's had a run-in with those two heroes at some point or another. I mean, with Strange being created in the late 60s and the Johnny Blaze version of the Ghost Rider in the early 70s, they've been around a long enough time that they've had run-ins with a lot of different villains.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think we're in agreement here that this show has just been fun. I mean, it's been a nice juxtaposition of different things. And I think it can be said that unless you really like the 50s and 60s sitcoms, you can get away with skipping the first two episodes and just
maybe even the first three. Yeah, even the third. I don't know. I said that at first, but I do think now the way that they're telling the stories, it probably would behoove you to watch them. It would help you a little bit, but yeah. I don't think you're going to be massively lost.
Right. And I thought they did a good job with those first two episodes, and they're only about a half hour long, so it wouldn't take right. that long to watch
it. It's not a major investment of your time, that's for sure. So I'm interested to see where they go, because I think that they've put enough breadcrumbs out there, dangled those carrots, as you like to say, that I wouldn't even be surprised when this is over if there's still more carrots being dangled and questions unanswered.
Right, which would then go on to be answered in Doctor right. Strange 2.
Is Wanda really going to turn into a bad guy? Is Agatha really a bad guy? Is she a good guy? Where's Sword Stand? What exactly are Monica's powers, and how is she going to use them? Is Pietro real? And is this how Quicksilver is resurrected? Is Vision resurrected? If Vision is resurrected, how is he able to be a quote unquote alive without the Infinity Stone in his head?
Yeah, because you see, when he tried to leave the Hex, he basically dismantled again, and it was Wanda expanding the Hex out that revived him.
I mean, even Darcy made the point, how's that possible? He's made of vibranium. It is interesting. We know they have not introduced adamantium yet in this universe. Now that they own the rights to the X-Men, they can, and I'm sure they will at some point. But as it stands right now, vibranium, it's the deus ex machina of the MCU. It's the element that was created that they use for everything. I mean, as much as I've enjoyed the Black Panther run, sometimes I felt they've been a little too dependent upon vibranium being able to do whatever they want it to do. So, but that's just a personal thing. That might not bother others.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up here for this edition of Geekville Radio. Once again, Geekville Radio is the website. You can respond to any of the posts we make there. Geekville Radio on Facebook and on Twitter. And we're open to discussion. Like I said, if you need to correct us on something, or if there's something you'd like us to talk about, we are all ears. And Train, if anybody wants to talk to you about country music or comics or whatever, where can they find you?
I'm always available on Twitter at crazytrain_JB. Like I like to say all the time, that's pretty much my handle across all platforms. And I'm a member of just about everyone you can think of. I may not check them very often, but I'm there. So if you want to get a response right away, the easiest way is either that or my Facebook page or the Examining the Dead Facebook page. Cheap plug, we will be recording one of those in the next couple of weeks. I've gathered enough information to where we can do that. And I think we've decided that with it being the month of February, at least for the next few days, the Gruesome Twosome this month, or this episode, is going to focus on Valentine-based or love story-based slasher movies. And that we agreed on?
Yep, indeed.
So look forward to that. And if there's any other breaking news, we'll be sure to let you know. And hey, if you want to have Buck Rogers as a nostalgia trip, the old Gil Gerard, Aaron Gray show, or you think he's worthy of induction into the lesser known Geek Hall of Fame, let us know that too.
Absolutely. So I'm going to shut off the lights here in the Malibu studio, and we will talk to you folks again next time.
Geekville Radio is not sponsored or endorsed by any products or services unless specifically stated. The views expressed by the hosts and or guests do not reflect the views of GeekvilleRadio.com, the Wrestling Brethren podcast, family, or any of their affiliates. Some media used in Geekville Radio is the product of their respective copyright holders, all rights reserved.
And regarding Cara Dune, I'd heard people say, oh, they should just recast Lucy Lawless. And I'm like, there's like a 12-year age difference.
12? I'd say more like 20, isn't there?
Actually, I think it's 15.